And welcome. I'm Dr. Mona Kular, and this is To Immunity and Beyond. I'm a medically trained doctor and nutrition and health coach, and I love helping people find the very best version of themselves. This show is all about living well, feeling well, and most importantly, aging well. The immune system is essentially the body's wellness system, so by understanding and supporting it, we can all reach an optimal level of health. I'll be having conversations with a wide range of experts from around the world on all the areas that can support our immune system to help us live healthier for longer. Let's live life better. Hello and welcome to Immunity and Beyond. This week, I'm really very excited to have Dr. Frank Lipman on the show with me. Dr. Lipman is widely regarded as a pioneer in the field of functional medicine and has written 6 best-selling books, including his latest one, The New Rules of Aging Well. We're going to be talking all about the lifestyle behaviours and habits that can contribute to slower, healthier aging processes so that we can live better for longer. This is a great conversation about how to live well in order to age well, and I think you'll really enjoy it. Hello, Dr. Lipman. Thank you so much for joining me today. It's an honour to have you on the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Before we start, would you be happy to just talk us through what it is that you do at the moment, what your background is, and a little bit more about yourself?
Sure. I've been a physician for 40-odd years. I was born and trained in South Africa and became a physician there in 1979. And I didn't want to live under apartheid, so we immigrated to the United States in 1984. I had to do a residency in internal medicine, and I became disillusioned with Western medicine very early on. Or, you know, it's a long story, but I started realizing that there were alternatives or other ways of treating people than my training. And actually, during my training in the United States, I became even more disillusioned because the training in South Africa, you get taught to speak to patients, to take a good history, to examine them properly. We didn't have the money to do all these expensive tests, so you really had to develop a relationship and get a good history. In America, it was very different. It was about what the blood shows, the EKG and the chest x-ray. So I was very disillusioned when I came to America, and I thought, well, how am I going to be a doctor? I didn't really want to practice that way. And there happened to be an acupuncture clinic attached to the hospital. This is 1984. I was in the South Bronx, which was a burnt out area in those days. And that's how I got into the United States. It was called a shortage area. So they were able to sponsor physicians they wanted because American physicians didn't want to work in those areas. And there happened to be an acupuncture clinic attached to the hospital doing detox on heroin and crack addicts, because heroin and crack was epidemic in those days in that particular area anyway. And so I went to the acupuncture clinic, and long story short, fell in love with acupuncture, started going there during my training, and realized there that the future of medicine would be some combination of some Chinese medicine and Western medicine, because in the hospital, we were doing crisis care, and Western medicine is wonderful at crisis care. If you break a bone, having a heart attack, if you have acute pneumonia, Western medicine is wonderful. But after that, if you're just tired and you've got some headaches and irritable bowel and you can't poop, Western medicine is not particularly good. And I noticed that the acupuncture clinic, they were helping those types of patients. So I saw that the two types of patients that we were helping in Chinese medicine and Western medicine were two completely different patients, and they were both good at what they were doing, but not particularly good at what the other was doing. And so I realized then in 84, 85, the future of medicine would be some combination of the two. And so I went on this journey of learning, you know, or trying to learn as much as I can to practice in a way that would help my patients. So I started with Chinese medicine and went on to nutrition and meditation and yoga and, you know, this whatever. So that was early on. That was in the 80s. And in those days, you know, it wasn't as popular as it was now. I had to find my own teachers. I searched out people I wanted to study with, and that's what it was in those days. And now today it's pretty not standard, but almost standard, this sort of integrative medicine, or using Western medicine when it's appropriate, but also using lifestyle and nutrition and diet and exercise and, you know, stress reduction, etc. So that's sort of my journey in a nutshell.
Yeah. I imagine when you first went across to the acupuncture clinic, there was a lot of skepticism amongst your colleagues, because at that time, 20 years ago, as you say, it wasn't really an approach that was
almost 40 years ago. Yeah.
So your journey started back then, but as you've just described, you're one of the pioneers, the leaders in this field, because you've sort of forged that path, haven't you, that other people have then followed. And whilst we are now looking at lifestyle medicine as a much more important part of patients' healthcare, it hasn't been that way for a really long time. And the difficulty, yeah. I mean, I used to work as a general practitioner, so the equivalent of a primary care practitioner. And the bulk of what we see is what you describe, people who are perhaps just generally unwell. They might have headaches, yeah. They're very vague symptoms. It's quite difficult to do tests and actually identify or pinpoint anything. And you need to sort of delve deeper into the root causes.
Sure. So it's what we call, what I call the worried well, or the, this is what's interesting. You know, you as a physician know that most of the people we see in a practice are not acutely ill, or, you know, aren't going to really do that well with Western medicine, because our tools in Western medicine are drugs or surgery. We don't really have other tools. So it was these other way, you know, it was Chinese medicine that led me to a different way of thinking about the body. And you mentioned root causes. Yeah. In Western medicine, we often just putting, and I'm not against Western medicine, don't get me wrong. I mean, if I'm having chest pain or pneumonia, I'm going to take an antibiotic. If I'm having chest pain, I'm going to go to the ICU. If I break a bone, I'm not going to do acupuncture on it. You know, I broke my wrist, I got my wrist fixed by. So I'm not against Western medicine, but, you know, I use Western medicine when it's appropriate. And, you know, you mentioned root cause. In Western medicine, we often just putting a band-aid on it, symptomatic treatment. You know, if the metaphor I always use, if you're driving your car and the oil light goes on, you don't put a band-aid over the oil light. You see why the oil light went on. So that's sort of how I started getting trained in Chinese medicine. You were always looking to see why the oil light went on. If someone had a symptom, you were looking to see what the underlying imbalances were to why that person presented with that symptom. You were looking for the cause. And so today, what I practice is this combination. We're sort of calling it functional medicine now, or that's the operating model, where we look for the cause, or the causes, which are often, you know, multiple causes, of why someone presents with heartburn. Instead of someone has heartburn, you don't just give them Nexium or something to suppress the heartburn. You see why that person has a heartburn. So it's a very different way of practicing. And, you know, the other point you mentioned as a GP, you know, people present with, you know, headaches and can't poop, you know, the worried well, or the walking wounded, whatever you want to call them. We do blood tests and they normal. And that's because in Western medicine, we see it as black and white. You're either sick or you're healthy. In Chinese medicine, I got taught there's this real grade between, so when someone's sick and someone is well, and your job is to sort of take them from that sick part towards, you know, the well part. So there's this functioning aspect of our organs that is important that we don't really look at in Western medicine. So the functioning of our system is really important, and that can be improved.
And there's the important part that many physicians have taken a long time to start to understand more, is that so many things are actually also connected. So when you adopt this band-aid approach, you might be suppressing one symptom, but if you haven't addressed that root cause, it's still going to bubble up somewhere else. And you can't just keep putting band-aids on all the different bits. It's when you look at that bit in the middle that's causing it, that actually all these seemingly unrelated symptoms may all resolve together because they could all be a result of one or two different things going on.
Exactly. We tend to play whack-a-mole in Western.
Yeah, absolutely.
The symptom comes up, yeah, and you whack it with a drug and then it pops up somewhere else. So, yeah, absolutely, yeah.
Yeah. Now, more recently, you have written an incredible book on aging well, and you've been talking a bit more about that. And that's something I wanted to discuss more with you today on this show. So why did you sort of venture into that that sort of more specific arena more recently? Was it something you were seeing more in your patients or something you became more interested in?
Yeah, all the above. You know, now that I'm almost 67, you know, when you get into your 60s, you start thinking about aging. And to me, aging well is just an extension of the same philosophy. Because what happens when you age, your functioning decreases, cellular function, organ, you know, everything, you know, your body's functioning is just not as good as it was maybe 20, 30 years ago. So, you know, what I do in my practice is help people improve function. I started realizing that aging, a lot of what happens in aging is just decreasing in function. And what you can do is slow down that decrease. You know, we're all going to age. There's nothing, you can't stop that. But how well you age is basically determined by how you live your life. So you can slow down that aging process. You know, yes, does my, are my hormones, is our general cellular function as good as it was 20, 30 years ago? No, but that doesn't mean I can't age well. So you've got to accept some decrease in function, but how quickly that functioning happens is determined by how you live your life, basically.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
It used to be hard to find the world's most wonderful alcohol-free drinks. Not anymore. Whether it's a health thing, a lifestyle thing, or you're trying new things, make sure you save yourself from the guessing game of the supermarket shelves and shop with zerozilchzip.co.uk for the world's most carefully curated range of alcohol-free beers, wines, spirits, and more. Health Radio listeners can save 5% with the code HEALTH5. Visit zerozilchzip.co.uk or click our banner on the UK Health Radio website. Discover alcohol freedom with Zero Zilch Zip, because nothing's better.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
And this is another sort of important concept, I think, to relay to people. The fact that I think many of us, or many people, think that aging is completely inevitable, which it is, but that we have to age in a certain way. And actually what you're saying and what we now know more about is that what we do and how we live can affect that process. It doesn't have to be that suddenly you become old and you can't do these things anymore, or you're going to get this disease. You can do things that could delay that, or in some cases even prevent it.
Yeah, absolutely. The concept that I work by that is starting to become sort of accepted is, in Western medicine, we talk about improving or increasing one's lifespan, but it's more about increasing your health span. I don't want to live to 120 and be sick and feeble and disabled for the last 40 years of my life. I would rather live to 100 or 90 and be vital until then, and just in a day or two, just snuff it, drop dead, and that's it. So you want to increase that span where you're healthy and vital, and compress that period of disability and where you're not functioning properly and you're not really living a full life to a very short time, days, weeks at the most. So it's more about increasing your health span and your lifespan, maybe, but it's really increasing the health span. And that's what I try to do for myself, for my patients. And I think that's what we all should be doing and what we all can do.
Yeah. It's like the quote, I'm sure you've heard of it, the idea is to die young as late as possible.
Exactly.
I can't remember who said it. I think it was Ashley Montague.
Ashley Montague, yes.
That's right.
Exactly. Yeah.
So if we look at aging as a process, are there key components we can break it down into? Are there key, you mentioned cellular processes, are there various key aspects of aging that we can almost look at or target individually, would you say?
Well, I think it all works together. You know, some people talk about telomeres, you know, those are those plastic ends of a shoelace, the equivalent, you know, they protect our telomeres, which tend to shorten as we get older. There's mitochondrial function, which are the energy powerhouses of our cells. I don't know if it, the way I look at it, you know, what, you know, the lifestyle changes of meditation or dealing with stress, cutting radically down on your sugar, moving your body, all these aspects which we recommend, I'm sure you recommend them to our patients, actually will affect the mitochondria, will affect the telomeres. So the actual mechanisms to me aren't important, although what happens as you get older, you're more prone to inflammation, your immune system doesn't work as well. But you know, ultimately, practically for most people, it's how do you change all those mechanisms, because by doing the same things and the same recommendations, you know, prolonging the time that you don't eat, for instance, fasting, all these ways of aging well affect these mechanisms. They'll decrease inflammation, they'll improve mitochondrial function, they'll maybe lengthen, you know, your telomeres, so or prevent the telomeres from shortening. So I'm less concerned, or I don't think about all these specific processes, because what I've realized, and you know, the more research I did into it, it's the same lifestyle changes you make that affect all those mechanisms for the most part.
Yeah, I do agree with that. I think we can get caught up on the minutiae, but you're right. It's looking at the overall picture of what you're doing, and actually, if that has a knock-on effect on all of those mechanisms,
exactly,
then it's not that they're not important, but you know that you're doing the right thing that's having that positive effect in all the right areas. So
exactly,
as you say, you mentioned the immune system, and as we age, that becomes less less optimal in its function, doesn't it? Just because a lot of the immune cells start to become less less functionally active and fit, and they go into senescence, which is when they're
yes,
they're sort of a zombie cell almost, aren't they? They're not, but then they need to be cleared out.
Exactly.
Then we have the mitochondria. They just start to decrease in function as we age. Is that just due to aging, the process, free radical damage and that sort of thing as we get older?
Yeah, I think all the above. So it's not that, you know, I'm now almost 67, but I am so much more aware of how to affect these processes in my body that I actually feel, I can't remember exactly, but I feel just as good as I felt maybe 20 years ago, but it's more effort. You know, I make a point of, like, I'll sauna, I'll do high interval training, I'll fast now every day, almost every day. I'll just have my cup of black coffee in the morning. So the way I've changed my lifestyle affects these things, which I think probably my mitochondria may be functioning better than they were 10, 15 years ago, because I wasn't that aware and I wasn't doing these things. So I think, yes, the functioning of the mitochondria, the functioning of your immune system, maybe chronic inflammation, all these things are affected by the aging process, no question about that. But you can affect that. And you know, I think I am personally, because, you know, I can see it and feel it in my body, and I see it with my patients too. So, yes, I think there needs to be an understanding. All those things do happen, but they don't have to happen as rapidly as, you know, they could happen.
Yeah.
Or you can affect change there. Yeah.
Yeah. And there's quite a lot of talk as well about longevity genes and the sirtuins.
Yeah.
And again, really, we need to look at it the way you've just described, and that what we're doing in our lifestyle is going to positively affect how they're expressed for us.
Exactly. So, you know, I mean, I do think, as you point out, these actual mechanisms are important, because I changed some things as I discovered new information, for me anyway. So as I started looking at the longevity gene, and so you talked about longevity genes, we now know there are 20 odd so genes that affect our longevity, and you can upregulate or downregulate or affect how they express themselves. Sirtuins are one of them. There's mTOR, mechanistic target of rapamycin. There's CAMPK. But there are a couple of these longevity genes that are can be affected positively or negatively by how we live our life. And now we know fasting, for instance, or long periods of not eating actually affect them positively. There's this concept of hormesis, for instance, which is a little bit of stress is actually good for your body. So chronic stress, we know, is bad for your body. But if you stress your body a little bit, it triggers mechanisms in the body which are good, so you know, whether it's for the mitochondria, for inflammation, or sugar dysregulation. These mechanisms can be affected by a bit of good stress, this concept of hormesis. So the idea of what doesn't kill us makes you stronger. And fasting is one of those mechanisms. If you don't eat for like 14 to 16 hours, it triggers mechanisms in your body which are actually positive for the aging process. When you go from extremely hot, like a sauna, into a cold plunge, for instance, or just extreme temperatures in general, having a cold shower at the end of a hot shower, that's a little bit of stress. It's a hormetic effect on the body, which is actually good for our longevity genes. So there are ways of affecting them. You know, we talked about high intensity interval training. A little spurt of pushing your body when you're exercising is good for your body. So these are the things that I've, you know, learned in the last, you know, five whatever years I started looking into aging, and realized that you can affect your body positively by small changes, not major changes in your life.
I'm glad you mentioned hormesis. It was something I was going to ask you to talk about. So within that sort of category of hormesis, you've mentioned the fasting, the temperature extremes, the interval training. Are there any others, or would you say they're the sort of main ones that are easy for us to implement ourselves?
I think those are the main ones. I'm sure there are other ones. I think fasting is probably one of the most powerful and easiest and most effective mechanisms for change. And I see it in my practice every day, because we sort of monitor biomarkers and how effective fasting can be for people's, you know, biomarkers in their bloods, their energy, their weight, their mental clarity. So they're these simple things, you know. So instead of having dinner at or eating till 10, 11 o'clock at night and having an early breakfast, instead of like having a 7-8 hour period of not eating, just extend it for another 4, 5, 6 hours, and you get so many beneficial effects from that. When you're exercising, just, you know, put in little spurts. There are these little things that can be done. You know, when you have a shower, have a little, you know, half a minute of a cold, freezing cold shower at the end. So little lifestyle changes can have a, you know, a large effect on your body.
Yeah. And how often would people need to do these sorts of things to gain the most benefit? You know, if we take each in turn, for example, would you recommend fasting every day, or can people get the same benefits from doing it, say, several days a week? And is there a minimum time frame? You know, if people reduce their eating window to, say, 12 hours, will they still get a benefit?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure of the exact answer to that, to be quite honest. I tend to get people to, you know, I think fasting for 12 hours is better than 8 or 10 hours. Fasting for 14 hours is even better. You know, what I've found with the research and with my patients, once you start going above 14 hours, you tend to get more bang for your buck. And you don't seem to have to do it. You know, I do it most days. I probably do it at least 6 days a week. I find this time is the easiest way to fast. It's because you're just basically eating dinner earlier and breakfast later. You know, I know in England the 5-2 method is popular. I you know, some people do one day a week, or sometimes do like three days a month. I just find getting into a habit of doing something regularly is the easiest for people. And that's why I'm a big fan of time-restricted eating, because we know that when you have long periods of not eating, it's a good, triggers these positive mechanisms in your body. So I'm a big fan of this daily or almost daily time-restricted eating. Does it have to be daily? Probably not. Can you do a 5-2, or can you do, 3 days a month? I'm sure you can. I can't say it's not as good. I just find this time-restricted eating most days a week seems to work best for most people in the way we live our lives today.
Yeah, I agree. And actually, what's important is making changes that people can implement and stick to on a regular basis. And some of the difficulty around perhaps 5-2 or even some of the other ones is they're slightly more extreme, in the sense that when you're doing those 2 days or you do 3 days in a month, it can be harder to stick to that. Whereas just a daily routine, whereas you say you have breakfast a bit later, you have dinner a bit earlier, once you get used to that, actually, it just becomes a normal part of life for you. So
exactly. Yep.
Now, with saunas and cold showers, do they have benefits individually on their own, or is it about the temperature change? Is it about going from the hot to the cold, or is doing them individually just as good?
Right. I think that's a great question. There's so much research on saunas in particular just extreme temperature alone is beneficial. I like that. I don't think you have to go from extreme hot to extreme cold to get that benefit. I think the extreme cold and the extreme heat, you get the benefit anyway. I personally like the effect of the extreme heat to the cold, but I don't think it's necessary, actually. Yeah.
And one of the mechanisms behind this, sorry to go into mechanisms again, I think people are interested as to why they do these things. And I think when they understand why, at some level, it helps them to stick with changes, is that they help to trigger this process of autophagy, which is essentially the body cleaning up cells that aren't functioning so well, or even cells that are dying or dead, and sort of getting rid of them, getting rid of that debris so that fresh new cells can come in. Is that the main mechanism behind
it? Yeah, I think that's one of the main mechanisms, because, we talked earlier about what happens when we age, our cellular function decreases. One of the biggest mechanisms that's decreasing is this clearing out the debris of cells, because part of what happens when you age is it's not functioning as well. It's this garbage collects. And once the garbage collects in your cells or in your organs, then you start getting these disease and the disease processes and chronic inflammation, whatever it is. But so stimulating this natural mechanism in our body, this detoxing, this cleansing. I mean, I talk about it sort of garbage collection and removal all at once. So stimulating this mechanism is probably one of the most important things you can do for your body, because that's a very key mechanism in aging. So as you point out, these extreme temperatures, fasting, all increases autophagy mechanism. So yes, that probably is one of the major mechanisms that's triggered by these little stresses on the body.
Yeah. So we've mentioned hormesis as one of the ways to improve your sort of cellular processes and help to optimize the aging process, shall we say. What other things are important? I mean, there's the obvious things like sleep, stress reduction, nutrition. Are there other areas you recommend as well? Or are those the main areas that you'd say are important to pay attention to?
Well, I think we all talk about, we know a low sugar diet is key. We know dealing with stress is key, and sleep and moving your body. Those are the four mechanisms that everyone talks about, which are really important. But we can't forget about the what I call the intangibles, like community. How important having a community that you feel comfortable within, that you can be yourself. I think that's really important. Having purpose and passion is really important. Being kind, I think, to yourself, to others, really important. Being, having gratitude, all these ordinary aspects of life have extraordinary effects on our health, being in nature. So I think a lot of these day-to-day things that we do that we don't think of as affecting our health have a huge effect on our health. And I can't stress enough, I think they're probably as important, if not more important, than how you eat, how you move, how you sleep, how you deal with stress, all of which are important. But if you don't have passion, if you don't, you know, and your purpose may be, you know, being with your children or your grandchildren, your purpose doesn't have to be changing the world. But having some type of purpose, having a community, feeling comfortable with, you know, people who love you and who you love around you, you know, all these things are really important. I think to me, kindness and being, you know, this gratitude thing is something that I struggled to sort of come to terms with, because I thought it was a real new agey thing. But I do think, this concept of just being, not wanting more and more, especially as you get older, just being comfortable with who you are, what you have, and being grateful for that. Actually, you know, I see it in my patients. I mean, it took me a long time to really get it, but I've seen my patients who are grateful for what they have, whether they have a little or a lot, generally do better. So I think these intangibles like being grateful, being kind, having purpose, all are muscles that can be worked on. You can actually, it's not you either have it or you don't have it. There are these mechanisms that can be improved. I think they probably have as much effect, if not more effect, than the standard ones we talk about.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
It used to be hard to find the world's most wonderful alcohol-free drinks. Not anymore. Whether it's a health thing, a lifestyle thing, or you're trying new things, make sure you save yourself from the guessing game of the supermarket shelves and shop with zerozilchzip.co.uk for the world's most carefully curated range of alcohol-free beers, wines, spirits, and more. Health Radio listeners can save 5% with the code HEALTH5. Visit zerozilchzip.co.uk or click our banner on the UK Health Radio website. Discover alcohol freedom with Zero Zilch Zip, because nothing's better.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Yeah, and I think the research is showing that more and more. Yeah. That as you say, these less thought about aspects of our overall health actually have huge impacts on how we, you know, exactly. How we live, yep. How our health is, and how we age. Yep. And I wonder if a large part of it is to do with actually reducing our overall stress levels, our overall cortisol, bringing that down, and that would in turn bring inflammation down. So you're almost soothing your immune system in a way by addressing those other aspects.
Exactly. I think once again, if we want to bring it down to what mechanisms in the body, your physician, you're thinking like that. That's why I think, yeah, I'm sure that's what's happening. I mean, whether it's kindness, gratitude, affect our hormones and our cellular function. You know, how it's working on a cellular level, I don't know for sure, but I think cortisol may be one of those mechanisms. But I have no doubt, because I've just seen it. I've been doing this for too long. I've been observing people for too long. And obviously I observe myself and be very mindful of what's going on. And I know it works. So, yeah. You know, yes, is it important to have research to confirm it? Yeah, but you know, if I see something working over and over again, I don't necessarily have to wait for the research to tell me that it's true.
Definitely. Can I ask, do you find that, because this is something I come across, there's a little bit more resistance to those aspects of things because it's less easy to measure, I suppose, exactly. Or see. So yeah, people are happy to change their food. I mean, not always happy, but they can understand that, change their food, change their exercise, try and address their sleep. Those things they can understand. And I think there can be just a little bit of friction when you try to get people to do these other things. because it's difficult, isn't it? What? How do you do it in your practice? How do you encourage your patients to understand the importance of these things and then to try and bring them into their lives more?
Well, it's a great point, and I think that's true. I think men in particular, women are definitely more aware and more open to this. I think women generally are more in touch with themselves and with what's going on. So I think women are it's less difficult to explain that to. I mean, they say, yeah, of course, yeah, they sort of know it. Men, it's more difficult because men want to see numbers. They're more, it's this yin and yang aspect of the way we see life. The yang being this very masculine and, you know, performance driven. And women are much more sensitive in this yin aspect. Obviously, it's not all men or women, but there's this masculine and feminine way of looking at it, maybe. Let's put it that way. But I think what the way I work with my patients is, I think most people, if you can get them to have a subjective experience of vitality or feeling good again, so if I can get someone to feel good quickly by changing their diet, in particular, you know, whatever way it is, if they can have a subjective experience of that, then they start trusting you more. And then you can sort of take them down this road of making them more aware of these type of things. It's not going to work with everyone, but it, you know, I really believe it's if someone trusts you and believes in you, there's more chance of it happening. And the trust and belief in you often happens if they start feeling better with your recommendations fairly quickly. So, I mean, I think that's why so many people trust the medical system, because, you know, if they have heartburn and you give them an Nexium, the heartburn goes away, so they think it's magic. But, you know, so how you bring everyone along that path is difficult. You've got to meet people where they're at. But I do think if you can, you know, if you can get someone to really trust you and believe in what you're doing, then it makes it much easier.
Yeah. No, I think there's a lot to be said for that. If you see patients who are slightly further into their, say, their aging process, do you find that it's harder to get them to take things on at that point? Does that make sense? So if they've already started to develop symptoms of chronic diseases and they're already sort of further down that process, sort of in their maybe 60s or 70s, for example, do you still get good results when you make changes with these patients?
Well, great question, because I think it's as you get older, it becomes harder and harder. Having said that, it's never too late to make changes. I mean, I've seen people in their 80s make changes and feel better. You know, will you get the same results as someone in their 50s? No, once that disease process has set in, depending on what the disease is, it's much, much harder to reverse, and often you aren't able to reverse it. But, you know, I've seen over the years so many people in their 70s, even 80s, make changes, and you see the changes. So, you know, expectations are important, but obviously the earlier you start making changes, you know, it's always better to prevent things. Once disease has set in, it's always harder. So, yes, it's harder, but, you know, it's never too late to make changes. You can feel better in your 70s and 80s. You know, does that mean you're going to run a marathon? No, but it may mean that you can enjoy your grandchildren more. You can just enjoy aspects of your life more than you were enjoying it. And I think that's important.
Yeah. And I just mentioned that because I do know that there are people who, once they get to a certain point, they become quite resigned to where they are and they feel that they're stuck and that's it. And actually that mindset then has a knock-on negative impact as well.
Yeah,
so
absolutely,
it's almost
yes.
Unraveling that and bringing it back. And as you just mentioned, it's starting where you are, isn't it? So if you are older, you're not going to suddenly be running, you know, whatever it happens to be. But actually those expectations of what you could do and then meeting that there rather than setting the goal too high or failing before you started because you feel like you'll never be able to do X, Y, or Z. I mean, but older people, for example, if they haven't been running marathons all their life, they're unlikely to suddenly start doing that. So you have to also be, I suppose, just realistic.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's about, as I said earlier, it's meeting people where they're at. So if someone comes to me and they're in chronic pain, their ways of maybe helping their pain, and you can say, they'll be able to play with their grandchildren more, or they'll be able to go out and play golf or whatever they want to play, a hobby that they had and they can't do anymore. They can't go walking outside or for whatever it is. There are little changes that can be made that they can get back some of their old life. And I think that's the most important thing. Yeah.
Yeah. And the other thing I wanted to ask is about that psychological aspect of, you mentioned earlier that you feel that you could still be 20 or 30 years younger than you are. And you certainly look it as well. So there's that psychological aspect that plays a big part in aging too, isn't there? Sort of staying young in your head and not thinking, right, that's it, I'm older and now I mustn't do X, Y, and Z and I have to do or have to be this way. When you stay young in your brain and the way you think and approach things, actually that helps your physiological aging process, bizarrely.
Yeah, absolutely. I think how you think about things, the lenses you use to see life are key. It's as we were saying earlier about the kindness and the gratitude. I think it's even more important. Where your head's at is really important. Being able to laugh about things, about the aging process, is very important. And I do think what I find helpful is when and this used to be the case in all cultures, it's a little bit less so now, but being around younger people, I think, being around younger people also helps you. So not just having friends that are your same age, but if you're around people who are younger and all different age groups, I think is very helpful. And that's how most societies used to be. You were in these big communities and they were old, they were young, everyone, mingled together. It's a little bit less of the case today. And I think that's a shame, because I find being around, I'm around younger people all the time and I love it. I find it invigorating for me. They like it because they, maybe like some of the knowledge and wisdom that I can bring to the table. And so everyone's getting a lot from these relationships, and I find them very, very helpful for me anyway. I love being around, not that I, I have lots of older friends. I love being around older people. I love being around younger people. I think that's important.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with that. And you can definitely see it when you look at groups of mixed ages, that there's a real dynamism there, actually, which I think is quite different to when you look at the groups that are all the same age, because there's so much to derive from people who are both younger and older than you.
Exactly.
And as you say, that goes back to, maybe what other cultures still have, but certainly what we probably used to have, some time ago.
Exactly.
You mentioned nature and spending time in nature as well. And I think another thing that can be very overlooked as part of just overall good health and aging, is this something, again, you find it's difficult to get people to do, or are they quite happy to? It's just about getting out more, isn't it? Into
exactly.
Open spaces.
Yeah. So if you're in London or you're a big city, you go, you got the best parks there in London. Are you in London? I don't know where you are, but
I'm in the Midlands, not too far.
Okay.
From
yeah, but in England, that there's so many parks and there's nature around you everywhere. Even in New York City, the parks. So yeah, I don't think you have to go to the beach or go to a forest, but if you can just get to nature. And that could be a park. I find, people know that. People know that when they're in nature, they feel much better. And, you talked about the cortisol. I'm sure that's, that's part of what's happening. I mean, there's something about being in nature that most people know how good they feel. I think that's important. I think if we can spend as much time as we can in these natural surroundings, there's so much we get from nature.
Yeah, I agree with that too. Is there anything else that you would say we haven't spoken about that's important for people to spend more time or more attention, give more attention to when it comes to aging well? We haven't really talked about sleep and nutrition, but I think they're big topics that most people understand the basics of.
I think the important things what I always say is the ordinary things that you do on a daily basis have an extraordinary effect on your health. Don't forget about being in nature, being kind, you know, spending time around people you love and with your family, and you know, having this community or whatever it is. I think those intangibles to me are as important, if not more important, than all these other really important aspects of health. And for people to realize that these are little tweaks that one can make. We're not talking about major changes. Now, if you're eating a lot of crap and your diet is full of processed foods and sugar, that's different. You need to really change that. But, you know, I've noticed little changes make a big difference. I've also noticed it's never too late. It's never too late to change one's diet. It's never too late to start moving. Don't accept feeling crappy, having aches and pains. It's just these normal parts of aging. That's not the case. They're normal aspects of decreasing function in the body, but you can always improve the functioning of your cells, of your organs, and of your body in general.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Dr. Lippmann. That's been a beautiful overview of aging. I know we're coming towards the end of our time. If people want to find out more about you, your work and what you're doing, or just connect with you, where's the best place for them to do that?
The best place is just to drfranklippmann.com, my website, drfranklippmann.com. I think, you know, I have an Instagram account. I don't do it. My health coach does an Instagram account for me. I do my Twitter and Facebook. I'm on Twitter. I put, you know, not that I answer, I'm not good at social media. I just do my thing. But yeah, the best place is my website, drfranklippmann.com. But I do post really cool stuff on Twitter. I don't really look at it. I just put it up there. I'm not a social media person, but I do put good information up, I think. So that's where you find me.
Brilliant. And your book, The New Rules of Aging Well, people can obviously get on Amazon or wherever they get their books from. And that's a great, goes into much more depth than all the areas we've just been talking about.
Great.
Yeah. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks, Mona. Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for listening today. And I really hope you've enjoyed this conversation. Do follow me on Instagram at The Health Span Doctor for information on the show, as well as recipes and health and nutrition advice. Until next week, let's live life better.